Stay aware. Good afternoon. Welcome to Aware. Hi, this is Lisa Garr. So let me ask you a question. You're driving in your car right now or wherever you are and you're listening to the station. Maybe you've heard the station, the news beforehand, or you listen to news, wherever you get your information, and you hear something that might be disturbing. And you get a sinking feeling and you think to yourself, I'm just one person. How am I going to make a difference in this global situation of global change? Well, actually, I have good news for you. There is a light at the end of that tunnel. Despite all we hear on this station and in the news and so forth about the signs of global distress, there is a new 80-page research study done by the research team at the Institute of Noetic Sciences, and it determines that the world is on a verge of a positive shift. Now, we've spoken about this before in the Aware Show, and we've interviewed many guests about it, and we've talked about it, but now there's some science behind it, which is very exciting, with statistics and studies and information, and it's put together by the Institute of Noetic Sciences, and apparently this is going to be an annual review, which I'm very excited about. So joining me is the president of IONS, James O'Day, and the vice president for research and education at IONS, which is the Institute of Noetic Sciences, Marilyn Schlitz. Thanks so much for joining me, both of you.
Thank you for having us.
Yes, thank you, Lisa.
It's a privilege
to talk to you again.
Oh, you too, and it's such a privilege to have both of you on the air. I know you're very busy people, and it's exciting to talk about this. So I want to ask you, Marilyn, how long did it take to put a report like this together?
Well, it's an ongoing process that is definitely a team effort with many advisors and consultants and experts in different disciplines coming together to share their reflections and their interpretations of what is changing. I feel that we are, in a way, between stories. There's an old story about the nature of our worldview and the way in which our society and culture is organized that more and more appears to be failing. And at the same time, there are glimmerings of something new that is waiting to be born out there. And so this report really offers a bridge between what we know isn't working and what we hold in our hearts as an aspiration for what might be possible for the human condition. So I would say the report itself took somewhere between 6 months and 9 months to put together. It's quite an ambitious undertaking.
Now, James, I understand that you're the brainchild of this, who saw the whole organization and kind of the idea of putting this all together. What was your inspiration? I mean, why did you decide to do this particular report?
Well, as you know, Lisa, in my own history, I've been through wars and suffering and human rights abuses close up. And, when I came to the Institute of Noetic Sciences, I saw in an organization like this the potential to really explore how consciousness itself could deal with the very fundamental changes and issues on the planet that we need today. And so, as Marilyn was saying, there's a divide between, a certain kind of secular, materialist, hardcore materialist view of the world and, that science, a certain form of science branches off into, and on the other hand, a very religious fundamentalist view. And yet, sort of as Paul Hawkins says, in Blessed Unrest, across the whole world, tens of thousands of organizations and groups and new thinkers have been exploring a new form of emergence. And this report really looks at the evidence of, a world transforming that really starts to bring in the interior, that deep stuff that, science may have thought initially was on the edges and peripheral, but is really the core of our capacity to see the world differently, acknowledge the power of our feelings, transform our attitudes and beliefs in ways that really begin to paint a picture of a global civilization that is possible in the future.
Now, if you could give us some examples of some of the evidence of something that stands out in your mind or the concept here.
Well, we have talked a lot about the issue of medicine itself. It's a good example of, in the field of medicine, you have what Dr. Rachel Remen calls, you know, a crisis where, you know, a large number of doctors don't want their kids to become doctors, where they're experiencing depression in a great degree. And so, you know, they're stressed themselves inside a medical system that is not functioning, that Sicko, I think, points out rather well. But there's also tremendous evidence of another form of new vision of medicine. You know, just a few years back, there were very few medical schools in the United States that had any kind of courses on spirituality and healing and health. And now over 100 such courses exist.
That's exciting.
If you look at the funding at the National Centers for Complementary and Alternative Medicine, in 1998, it was about $19 million. In 2006, it was over $122 million was going into this new field. So there's solid evidence, you know, the emergence of the Holistic Nurses Association and so on and so on, that really those ideas that we talk about in the report and that Marilyn so brilliantly describes in our book on consciousness and healing are taking root.
Yes, and the studies that I'm really glad, especially in the book, the Consciousness and Healing book, by the way, which is fabulous, you put together all of the studies of what's been talked about with Larry Dossey and with Deepak Chopra and Rachel Naomi Remen, which you were just talking about. They're all in one place there, which is really great. And they're all doing the same thing in different ways, but with the same type of consciousness. And as is Bruce Lipton and so forth, they are showing in laboratory and double-blind studies and situations where, you know, healing on plants growing and so forth in petri dishes, that the power, the incredible power of intention and consciousness and focus, it's tangible now. And it's being seen in some of these studies. Marilyn, could you share with me one of the things that you found that was the most profound about that?
Well, I mean, I'd have a couple of responses to that.
Please, yes.
First, the book really, I think, in a way, was an honoring of the pioneers who helped to, you know, set the foundation for the emergence of a more humanistic medicine for 21st century living, and who really represent an appreciation for the role of consciousness, mind, beliefs, worldview, and what those mean in terms of understanding health and healing. And on the other hand, I think that what we tried to do in that book is create a new roadmap for what we can grow into as we're trying to get through the crisis in medicine and build to something that really recognizes the fullness of our humanness. And in saying that, it's also a recognition that to be healthy involves, you know, a healthy body that's working in perfect harmony. It involves a clarity between our beliefs and our body, because it's very clear from the science that our beliefs and our emotions have a very clear and unambiguous linkage to our immune system and our endocrine system. And so how do we really begin to become more aware of the ways in which negative thoughts, for example, can actually depress our ability to fight disease? I think there's also that sense of our connection to the environment and recognizing that, as you know, the great deconstructionist Ivan Illich said, it's hard to be healthy in a sick society. You know, how do we recognize that the social and biological environment we live in, you know, is fundamentally connected to our sense of health and well-being? And then finally, I think that there's a sense of connection to that sense of transcendence, or the what one might call the spiritual aspects of our being. And again, if you turn to science, we're seeing today that there's increasing evidence, thousands of studies now, that support the link between religious and spiritual participation and positive health outcomes. A recent study that was published in one of the leading neurology journals found that people with the predisposition for Alzheimer's, who were involved in some kind of spiritual or religious practice, had far greater degree of resilience far less diminishment of their cognitive capacities if they had a spiritual and religious practice as compared to those people who didn't. So it appears that there are many dimensions that promote healing, and I think it's, you know, one of the most inspiring aspects of this thing is that we are being called to wholeness, and in that call, recognizing that all the pieces have to be figured in order to have a complete model of medicine, a complete model of science, you know, a complete model for society.
You know what? It's interesting that we, you know, we are striving to achieve this, but yet this exists, this wholeness exists in Taoism, in Hinduism, and in Buddhism in many places. Why are we striving so much to achieve this in the Western world? But you're also talking about a global situation here.
Well, I think, again, you know, going back to the original point, we are, in a sense, between stories, and we are at a time when different truth systems are meeting, in some ways, for the first time. So we have science and the enormous successes of Western science, you know, our ability to utilize Newtonian physics to get people safely to that orbiting space station up in outer space and bring them home again is a great display of the effectiveness of the materialist physicalist model. And at the same time, what we're discovering is ancient truths coming from the world's religious, spiritual, and wisdom traditions
mm-hmm.
about, you know, these kind of core capacities of inner space. So on the one hand, we have great utility in understanding the external world outside of ourselves, but more and more we're discovering that there's also this inner space, the realm of human consciousness that allows us to access, you know, our human potential in an entirely new way. So part of what I think is emerging in terms of the new story is a convergence between these two major truth systems, the rigor and discernment that comes from science, the predictability of that kind of physicalist model, with then the wisdom and the deep appreciation for, you know, the core of our being. And as these two things come together for the first time, you know, there are new questions that are being asked and new opportunities for discovery that, you know, we hadn't understood before. It's one of the things, we have a big conference coming up in Palm Springs in August, August 9th through the 12th, and we're really dedicating this conference to this convergence, this notion that there is a new story that's emerging out of these different truth systems, and that by accepting and appreciating the values of both, but the lack of wholeness if you treat them separately,
mm-hmm.
That will allow us. And so we're really excited about, A, you know, really digging into what is this new story, celebrating with all of the folks who attend this conference our own participation in the emergence of this new story. And then thirdly, what are the tool sets and skill sets that are going to be needed
yes.
as we navigate into this new future?
And that's one of the things I want to talk to you about, are some of the practical steps on how to close this gap that we're looking at. That's getting smaller and smaller. But, I mean, one of the first steps in what you're doing with this report is showing some of the science behind it about how our beliefs respond to our environment and how we can literally, you know, cause ourselves to grow if we are in a positive environment and cause ourselves to die if we're in a negative environment. Now you take that microcosm and you put that into the macrocosm and you look at our world situation and you just, you know, you chunk up and you say, okay, well, in this positive environment, these tests were done and these studies were done and this meditation was done and less violence was created on this day when there was a day of 40,000 people praying, there was less violence and there was, you know, when this particular prayer study or group was focused on this particular group of individuals that were recovering from surgery, there's less use of medication, faster recovery, and shorter time in the hospital. So there's all sorts of that whole type of thing you're basically taking and you're chunking up to a worldview. Is that right?
James.
Go ahead, James O'Day.
Yes. I think one essential part of that shift, as we're saying, is that your own experience, your own internal experience is a vital part of reframing whatever is coming at you. And so in the old model of medicine, you had, you held your arm out and you said, you know, do it to me, cure me, give me the pill, give me the answer, give me the solution. Almost as if you were an object that could be taken care of in that way. And now, just as a paradigmatic of the shift that we're talking about, we say how central your own attitude with regard to your mind-body health, your own attunement to your own emotional field, your own development of your capacity to attend and be aware, begins itself to really shift your perception of the nature of reality itself. And the reality that begins to unfold when you do pay attention to those things is one in which the world itself is entirely more relational than maybe it was before,
mm-hmm.
that the quality of the relationships you have with anyone, with any person in your life, can be transformed, and you begin to see the connective tissue between people and the social order. And just as in the world of, you know, quantum physics, where deep, you know, into that terrain of the quantum world, we begin to look at a new paradigm, a new vision of interconnectedness at that level. So also from that inner spiritual and psychological shift, we begin to see how profoundly connected we are to each other. That's a huge place for the world to turn towards. And in the shift report, Evidence of a World Transforming, we really look at the variety of ways in the field of education and medicine and in globalization that this interiority meeting the exterior world begins to shift our values, our perceptions in ways that are very healthy.
Let me ask you a quick question. Is the shift report, it's an 80-page report, by the way, is it available online for people to view?
It will be available online soon. They can still buy copies of the hard report itself. There are still hard copy
reports
available.
At noetic.org, okay. www.noetic.org.
Okay, yeah, this is a great report. Now, the in terms of the Internet, actually, how do you think the Internet plays in all of this with the convergence? I mean, it has basically brought this globe down to the size of a 12-by-12-inch screen. Is this kind of an idea of what you're talking about?
I think the Internet, some people use the whole idea of the Internet,
mm-hmm.
that
yeah.
in fact, you know, the nature of reality may be that the Internet is a reflection of the deeper wiring of our connectivity.
If it's
so
used
we
right,
have,
yes.
We have in consciousness itself something beyond the Internet, at least as a model to look at of our connectedness. And so as a mirror of our connectedness, it is profoundly significant, but it can also mirror our greed and many of the other sort of elements that we're struggling with at this point.
There's lots of choices, yeah. There's lots of choices, and it could be used. It depends on how you use it, and the listener asked that question, so thank you very much. Let me ask you about how what you talk about in the shift report has anything to do with organized religions that were previously patriarchal and dominating. And do you think that the awareness of this different type of spiritual connectivity would have those types of religions fall off? Do you know what I mean?
I think that one of the things that, in terms of skill sets we need for the 21st century, is the ability to hold ambiguity and the complexities that come when you factor in multiple ontologies. The fact that there are multiple models of reality that coexist at the same time. And so people have different images of, you know, what is the essence of the human condition? What are we capable of being? Who is it that we are, you know, developing into, and what is our relationship to that beyond ourself, whether we call it God or Allah or Buddha or whatever the name is that we put on that. I really feel like it's a time of pluralism, And one of the skill sets that we're going to need is the capacity to hold that there are things and ideas and belief systems that people hold that may not be compatible with our own in their entirety. And yet what we've seen, we just completed a 10-year program of research to look at the nature of transformation. And in that, we interviewed practitioners from most of the major world religions, many spiritual practitioners from more non-affiliated traditions, paganism. We had a number of the kind of emergent new transformative practice type teachers that we interviewed. And what we found is a lot of difference in terms of the kind of practice or what they feel is important in terms of the day-to-day activities. But we also found a tremendous amount of convergence. There are these perennial truths that emerge across these different traditions. And so as we're growing into this new worldview and all of the complexities that come with it, it's how to find the core ways in which you and I and you know, people on the other side of the planet all share some assumptions about, you know, what's important. Our children are important to us. A cultivation of love and caring and compassion is important to all of the different traditions.
Mm-hmm.
And that there are ways to get there that are simple and direct. So I don't think that we want to vilify or push aside anything at this point. I think we don't know enough about, you know, what's coming to think that we can eliminate some of the possible answers.
That's very, very well stated. Yesterday I had the privilege to interview Rianne Eisler.
Mm-hmm. She'll be at our big conference in Palm Springs in August.
Oh, great. And the new book on the Real Wealth of Nations talks about that, creating a caring economics, and it has a lot to do with childcare. And corporations and businesses actually profiting more by releasing or allowing their employees to have more time with their families and more time on continuing education. And they've done some studies that there was a return of one particular company of 521% in 4 years when they offered these employees, childcare and time. And it's true, because then it teaches you to focus more on a shorter amount of time. You get more done in that shorter amount of time, and then you get the quality of life that enables you to have that positive type of outlook on everything when you get to spend time with families or even your own continuing education, which is terrific.
I do think when you were talking about the patriarchal religions or the political dominator models that are associated with rigid hierarchies, yes, we are fundamentally saying the shift is a shift away from those modalities, and that we see in that sort of wave, if you could capture the wave, it would include social pluralism and authentic democracy, the whole movement of the mind-body medicine, an appreciation for emotional and social intelligence that then leads to an eco-sustainable and humane economies and business, and the appreciation, as Marilyn said, of both indigenous and perennial wisdom, leading to a whole waveform in the shift of consciousness, so that it is, you know, what people call the feminization, it is certainly a movement away from the old dominator patriarchal model.
Mm-hmm. And then let's talk about a little bit about where we're heading and how you think that we could influence policymaking and really have some significant change that happens as a result of this. What is your intention with this?
Well, one of the things we point out in the SHIFT report, and that people will experience in a very vital way with the people who are attending the conference, and Marilyn's mentioned it, we're still encouraging people to come. It's August 9th to the 12th. It's just there in Palm Springs at La Quinta. And to experience a thousand people who are in community, who are really looking in a very intelligent and discerning way at these kind of transformations and social changes and shifts in consciousness, gives you an experience and contact with what is happening in a way that is a little bit more remote if you're just getting it from the website or the book. But one of the things in the SHIFT report we point out is the whole movement in positive psychology, that while, you know, the beginning of the SHIFT report points out where there is a significant crashing, and probably in the next 4 years, where we're going to see a lot more of the breakdown of the old forms. And so that can shock, it can traumatize, it can paralyze people. And yet, this report and that movement in positive psychology is to say, even with your own wounds and your own hurts and the place where you feel, you know, that the world has traumatized you personally, this movement in positive psychology suggests that you look for your strengths, the places where your virtues come through, where you're still alive and where you still have that force and vitality, and build on that. And so what we're doing in this report is building on the tremendous vitality of, in the evolutionary sense, of what is emerging, what is coming towards us, the future that is coming towards us that contains so much healing capacity. And so I think that is one vital practice, Lisa, that we would encourage people to not get stunned by the degree of trauma, which when we really contemplate it and we can't live in denial, is severe at this time.
I like the study that you have done, the 10-year study on personal transformation, and about the consistent findings. And Marilyn, maybe you could talk about this, where profound personal transformations are frequently triggered by intense pain.
That's one of the common elements across the different practices, and it makes sense, really. If you have habits, and they may be bad habits or good habits, but oftentimes what people are hoping to move away from are the things that are more dysfunctional in their life, things that aren't serving them, it's very hard to break habits. And oftentimes a person needs kind of to be pushed into making a kind of life change or a worldview change that ultimately ripples out. I was interested in your question about the politics. Stephen Post is a close colleague of ours who is involved in this positive psychology movement, runs the Center for Unlimited Love at Case Western Reserve, and he was just invited to come and talk to the Senate about ways to facilitate altruism and compassion. And so John Kabat-Zinn, another person who we work with, talks about the importance of this kind of inner revolution. And as we become more aware of our own authentic voice and our own needs outside of what the culture is pushing on us, but what is true for ourselves, that as we gain that kind of introspective awareness, it then has a ripple effect into the world. And, you know, he holds this fantasy that ultimately we will have all our politicians practicing mindfulness in such a way that they can facilitate their own inner awareness in ways that, you know, George Bush calls navel gazing, but I think he could use a little more navel gazing. Sorry for the political commentary. But how do we really bring this kind of self-reflection into the body politic and really recognizing that each of us is part of something bigger, and that rather than thinking it's only about getting out there and demonstrating, how do we begin to cause a shift in ourselves that allows us greater peace and greater wholeness, and then watch as that sense of ease begins to ripple out into our world and into our relationships. And
well, I think it's interesting what you put in the SHIFT report about the studies on the brain on how meditation impacts the empathy center of the brain, and that, you know, that is really an effective tool to learn how to have personal empathy and global empathy. Some of these reports on the global meditation have been very, very effective. And that makes a lot of sense. Can you tell me a little bit about the, I read it briefly about the, I'm going to get this wrong, but the growth, the happiness project, or the, am I ringing any bells here? I'm looking for where I saw this. But it has to do with, here it is, the United Nations Human Development Index and the Gross National Happiness Index.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, we talk a lot about the gross national product.
Yes.
As though that is the way to evaluate the standard of our living. And yet we've seen experiments across the globe of attempts to evaluate the success of the nation based not on its productivity in terms of the material aspects, but how full and complete does that population feel? How happy are they? The government of Bhutan, for example, instituted this policy of creating a happiness index that would evaluate, you know, the overall quality of life of its citizens. Unfortunately, there were some difficulties when, at the same time as people were calling for, you know, this kind of holistic view, they were also calling for television. And with the importation of a lot of Western-based television programs, it has had kind of a confounding effect on this happiness quotient.
Oh, that's interesting.
So how is it that the images and the kind of collective dreaming that society puts into our heads, how does that affect our sense of well-being and our sense of confidence? It's an opportunity when you think like this, you know, something like the gross national product, okay? We all take it for granted. We've heard it so many times. But transformation is about this subtle little shift in perspective. What if instead of evaluating the basis of our currency on the gold standard, for example, we base it on renewable resources and the opportunity to really invest in something that has long-term consequences for the future? These things are subtle shifts in perspective that ultimately can have a ripple effect on every domain of human action.
Yes, I believe that all change happens at the subconscious level, and you can think about it as much as you want, but until you really ingrain it into the unconscious mind, which of course operates 96 debatably percentage of our lives, that it won't really, really, truly happen. And you kind of back that up when you say, in order to create and sustain positive change, there needs to be three common patterns of behavior. Would either of you care to take us through that?
You're talking about the intention,
yes.
Attention, and repetition.
Yes.
Well, when we looked at the common elements of how somebody begins to change, you know, let's just take an example. All of us can relate to the fact that we have felt abused by someone. We carry a grudge.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody violated us in some way, you know, and that's very real. You know, people have been violated in all kinds of ways. The question is, how many times do you story that? How many times does that violation of you have to be repeated in order for you to feel complete? And one of our colleagues, Fred Luskin at the Stanford Forgiveness Project, talks about how if you've storied something seven times, probably that's enough. Because what happens is that our brain lays down neural pathways, and it's like grooves in the brain. And so the more you repeat something that doesn't serve you ultimately, the more that becomes your habit. And so what we have learned in terms of our research on transformation is that there's sort of three qualities that can help us to reconfigure the neural pathways in our brain and in our behavior and in our perceptions. One is the intention to bring about a change. It is really recognizing that there are choice points. Do I story this violation over and over again as an abuse of me? Or do I begin to recognize that, yes, there was a learning in that for me? And I reframe it. So I bring my intention to that simple reframing. The second element is attention. Where am I placing my attention? Am I choosing to place my attention in all the ways that I'm unhappy? Or do I choose to place my attention and my perception on those things that bring greater satisfaction and life fulfillment? Even if they're difficult, even if it's a difficult relationship, if I place my attention and my intention on a positive outcome, then I'm much more likely to perceive it that way. And then thirdly, this idea of repetition. In order to build new habits out of the old ones, it involves repetition.
Doing them over and over again, yes.
So just even if you're feeling cranky, smile. And then you notice somebody smiles back at you, and that increases the likelihood that you want to smile. And slowly, you're beginning to build a new set of practices, a new way of perceiving, and a new sense of, you know, what your intentions can bring into your life.
Mm-hmm. That's a great way of doing it, to have the intention to change, then pay attention to where you're not changing, the old repetitive habits that you don't want to have any longer. Just be aware of the fact that they're there, but then repeat new patterns and sustain positive change. So I want to tell the listeners really quickly about the IONS conference that's coming up in August, next month. August 9th through 12th is the Science and Practice of Transformation in Palm Springs. Many of the people that you have heard James and Marilyn talk about are going to be at this conference. Share with us some of the people that you've just said.
And Lynn McTaggart, whom you mentioned, her wonderful bestseller at the moment is widely read by our members. She'll be there. And Andrew Harvey, pioneer in sacred activism. Robert Thurman, the leading American scholar of Tibetan Buddhism. And Van Jones, who, the Yale lawyer who created the Ella Baker Center for Human Rights, who's really combining new consciousness approaches and inner city life and issues on prisons. So he's really taking all of those into the heart of social change and many more, right, Marilyn?
Well, we have a town hall meeting where we have health professionals, nurses, doctors, patients coming together to have a discussion about the future of healthcare and
so
to really engage in a collective dreaming.
All this can be found at noetic.org, right? That's noetic.
That's right.
Okay, great.
Or 707-775-3500.
Well, thank you so much, James O'Day and Marilyn Smith. I really appreciate your contributions to this report. Again, you can find it at noetic.org. It is the SHIFT report, the 2007 SHIFT report put on by the Institute of Noetic Sciences. Thank you both very much for joining me.
Thank you, and we hope to see you at our conference.
Oh, that
bye
would be
bye.
Fabulous. So this is Lisa Garr. You're listening to The Aware Show on KPFK.